Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Back to the question of names and their sometimes troubled history. Earlier this hour, we looked at a local controversy over the name of a school playing out in Jacksonville, Florida. But that's just one example that might raise questions. Plenty of pro and school teams have used Native American imagery over time. And a lot of those names, like the use of Confederate flags, have been deemed offensive to communities in our time who see all of these symbols and references much differently. Joining us now to talk about the challenge of naming and renaming is Dr. Leah Wright, Professor of History and African-American Studies at Wesleyan. Dr. Wright, welcome.
Hi. Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
How complicated are these name changes and the history that they really unsettle when the name suddenly becomes the focus of attention in a community?
So the history behind them is hugely controversial. I think on the one hand, there's definitely a technical aspect to these kinds of things, whereby it can be easy to change names. Sometimes it can be difficult to change names. But I think what's much more problematic and much more difficult to handle is the history surrounding the names and the way in which different communities in the present really grapple and go back and forth over what the names mean and why they should change them. The emotions surrounding name changes are just very, very heated deeply kind of felt by both sides.
Let's look at the Native American imagery in the NFL just for a moment. I mean, you've got on the one hand the redskin idea, which is very, very racial. It comes out of a time when there was a kind of an honorary sense of remembering Indians and remembering the heroism of them. And there are even teams called the Warriors and the Braves who take it away from the purely racial aspect. And then you've got over in Seattle the Seahawks that uses an actual Native American symbol of tribes that still are active in the Pacific Northwest, as though it's really integrated into the community. There's history and controversy in each one of those approaches, yes?
Right. And I'm glad that you mentioned the Washington Redskins example. I believe in the last few days, a D.C. council actually voted to call upon the Redskins to change their name, citing the derogatory and racist imagery surrounding the Redskins logo and the name, and citing, you know, the history of Native Americans in this country. The owner of the Redskins said, you know, I unequivocally refuse to change the name and I will not change the name. And I think this brings up a lot of the dramatics surrounding the issue. I mean, the history right there is deeply problematic. Having a mascot of a people really just dismisses the plight or the history or even the struggles that these people have gone through. It is derogatory to have, you know, a Native American imagery as a mascot and say, this is, you know, what stands for our team in almost a way that mocks people's history.
Does America's diversity and the fact that there are likely to be communities who are represented by specific groups that are named, you know, as sports teams, mean that in many ways it might be safer in America to stick with, you know, creeks and rivers as a name source?
Well, you know, I think that naming comes out of a tradition, or a lot of naming these mascots come out of a tradition, as I mentioned earlier, of commemoration of certain things, but commemoration from the perspective of outside of the minority's perspective or outside of the subjugated group's perspective. So I think just going forward, it makes much more sense to just avoid taking racial groups or taking ethnic groups and saying this is going to be a mascot. It's much, I think, much more salient, makes much more sense just to avoid that kind of thing altogether.
How come Robert E. Lee actually survives as a plausible figure, even though he was a general, the most famous general of the Confederacy?
Well, you know, I think part of this is part of this myth of the Old South, right, which comes about in the aftermath of the Civil War. How does an entire group of people, an entire culture, deal with a monumental loss? the loss of the Civil War? How do we rebuild our society? How do we come to terms with something like that? And how do we come to terms with an entirely new group of people being integrated into the population and being told that they are now human, and now we have to, you know, deal with them? And so what we start to see is a lot of commemoration. We see a lot of parades, figures, statues, and also myth-making, where people start telling these kind of grandiose stories about what really happened during the Civil War, who were the real heroes, and how those things become repeated time and time and time again, and how they actually become ingrained into society. And I think that's how someone like Lee becomes kind of a hero figure in and remains a human figure, despite the fact that he was a Confederate general.
And of course, Nathan Forrest doesn't necessarily qualify or pass the Robert E. Lee standard. He's also a Confederate general, but because he was the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan up in Jacksonville, they've got a problem.
Right. They've got a huge problem. And I think what's interesting about that is that a lot of these charged emotions that surround the Jacksonville case come out from a particular place where people say, well, you know, Forster wasn't necessarily that kind of a racist, or, you know, it's not about what he did in the Ku Klux Klan, or he may have left it, or the organization didn't stand for those kinds of things, which is also part of this kind of idea of myth making, this idea of taking a narrative and using it to repair a part of the country or region's history. It completely ignores the aspect that actually the Ku Klux Klan does come about not only as a gentleman's club, but as a racist segregationist club designed to exclude and actually target African Americans.
And so when Jacksonville makes a decision to change this name, does the history go away? Is it a controversy that then poof vanishes, or does it live in an undercurrent? And, you know, what's the new name going to be?
Well, I don't even think that it lives in an undercurrent. I think that it actually, it continues. And part of this is because it's built into the culture of a particular area and a place in time. Maybe over many, many years, it'll disappear. Or maybe even in changing the name, it's a step towards kind of reconciling those tense feelings. But there, on both sides of the equation, there are people who have very charged emotion. And there are people who also feel very strongly that the school name should be changed. I don't think that goes away overnight.
Dr. Leah M. Wright is a professor of history and African-American studies at Wesleyan University. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, John.